Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you today, Tuesday, December 17th, 2019. President Kiir and Riek Machar say they'll form a unity government before the latest deadline, but have yet to nail down a deal on the tougher issues.
We and the guarantor have said after the 100 days, we have to form the government. And if there are other things not done, we will task that government because that is a unity government.
And the MPTC gets more money to do its work.
I urge the mechanisms to coordinate effectively amongst themselves and to prioritize the screening and selection of forces for training.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar say they have agreed to form a unity government by the February deadline, despite challenges that remain. After an hour-long meeting at the State House today in Juba, Kiir and Machar both said they would complete implementation of security arrangements by the end of the 100 days of the extended deadline, but did not agree on the number of states or their boundaries. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu has this report from Juba.
President Kiir and Machar emerged from their meeting this afternoon to confirm to reporters they did not reach agreement on the contentious issue of states and boundaries. Machar spoke first before the cameras in Arabic.
We are not able to move ahead, but we said let us wait until the Deputy Vice President of South Africa comes, because he was the one working with our committees. We will come and listen to his report. Maybe he will come and help us with the issue of the number of states.
Speaking in Arabic alongside Machar and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, Deputy President of the Sudanese Transitional Military Council, President Kiir said, despite reaching no deal on the number of states, he will form a unity government with Machar in February.
We and the guarantor have said after the 100 days, we have to form the government. And if there are other things not done, we will task that government because that is a unity government. We will task it with the things that are not completed and implement them.
Kiir emphasized that no one should return the country to war. Machar says he and the president agreed to ensure that all security arrangements, including cantonment, training of joint security forces, and the redeployment of forces, is completed before the 100 days of the pre-transitional period expires.
We have reached an understanding that in a period of 1 or 2 weeks, we should be able to start training of the security forces in the training grounds, say in Gorom, in Upper Nile, or in Owinkibul, or in Mapel, and so on, so that we are able to meet the 100 days deadline. Because we want, by the time we finish the 100 days, there is a ready joint security force.
The failure by the parties to resolve the issue of number of states, their boundaries and all security arrangements has prompted the U.S. government to place sanctions on certain individuals it says has impeded the peace process. The parties missed two previous deadlines to form the unity government, one in May and an extended deadline in November. Lack of trust between the two leaders has also been a factor in delaying the formation of the unity government. Machar says he and Kiir agreed to expand access across the country to create a free environment for the effective implementation of the peace agreement.
We agreed to open for political space and freedoms for free movement and so on, so that we as parties to the peace agreement, we can be in a position to start programs of disseminating the peace agreement to all the citizens.
The two leaders did not take questions from reporters at the end of their meeting. Machar is expected to return to Khartoum soon. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The United States government has imposed new sanctions on two more individuals who are South Sudan cabinet ministers for standing in the way of implementing the revitalized peace deal. South Sudan government spokesman and information minister Michael McQuay says the U.S. is opposed to the Kiir administration and wants to weaken its regime. Defense Minister Kual Manyang-Juk and Cabinet Affairs Minister Elia Lamora Makana were both sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury Department for, quote, perpetuating the conflict and sabotaging the South Sudan peace process, end quote. The move comes a few days after the U.S. blacklisted five other South Sudanese individuals for their alleged role in kidnapping Dong Samuel Lula, a South Sudan human rights lawyer, and Agri Idri, a member of the SPLM-IO. McQuay told reporters they don't want the current system to continue, so their policy is to weaken it by any possible means so that the opposition takes over. The U.S. Treasury Department says Kual Manyang did not withdraw SSDPF soldiers from the battlefields as stipulated in the pre-transitional security arrangements. They also accused him of recruiting militias in preparation for a renewed conflict. The government has given the National Pre-Transitional Committee, or NPTC, $16 million more U.S. dollars to screen, train, and unify South Sudan's forces. The money is part of the $40 million the government said it handed over to the NPTC last month. Onan Walter Solomon has the details for VOA from Juba.
NPTC Secretary Martin Elia Lumoro, who is also South Sudan's Minister of Cabinet Affairs, one of two ministers sanctioned by the U.S. government this week for allegedly fomenting conflict in South Sudan, told stakeholders at a reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission meeting today. The NPTC doled out the money late last week to various committees responsible for security arrangements.
The MCC got $4 million for that. The JTSC, which is the main body, had a very huge budget of something like $26 million, and they got $5 million. The DDR, they were given $2 million, and they have started their work. We then have the Strategic Defense Security Board. They got $1.1 million. Citizen Board, $151,250,000. Citizen CT, $270,000. NAC, National Constitutional Amendment Committee, has 315,804, and the RGMA has 260,000.
JTSC stands for Joint Transitional Security Committee. DDR stands for Disarmament, Demobilization, and Reintegration Committee. And CITESAM stands for Ceasefire and Transitional Security Arrangement Monitoring Mechanism. All of the funds disbursed were in U.S. dollars. Ambassador General Njoroge confirms the mechanism's committee received funds last Friday. Njoroge says it is very disappointing that no significant progress is being made on implementing pre-transitional tasks. He says, despite the late release of the funds, the parties have implemented some activities. Njoroge called on all committees to be transparent about how they are using their funds.
I urge the mechanisms to coordinate effectively amongst themselves and to prioritize the screening and selection of forces for training and to ensure the delivery of food and supplies to cantonment sites and training centers. The security supervision mechanism to commence its work and closely coordinate with the NPTC, the Office of the IGAD Special Envoy for South Sudan, RGMEC, and the CITESAM VM.
In October, dozens of soldiers were said to have left the Pantit cantonment site in Awil due to a lack of food and other basic supplies. Elia says all of the cantonment site should be well stocked at this point.
I don't understand why people say that the food is not being taken to cantonments. I have insisted that let people go to the stores. You know, all of your ambassadors, you can just walk in there and see for yourself. I understand you got sent somebody there.
Elia says his committee delivered different volumes of food such as rice and sorghum to various cantonment sites per the requirements of the JMCC. He says food donations were sent with strict MOUs. to ensure that the food is not misused or sold for profit in the market.
We are ready to present a full accountability report for the funds that we received, ready to present a full accountability report for the in-kind support and donations given to us.
Elias says the total funding allocated to the security mechanism is $16.5 million, constituting 41.46% of the budget allocated for implementing the pre-transitional tasks. Jorge says the NPTC allocated $260,000 to support the representatives of the parties to the RGMA. Akuoch Ajang Nyanom, chairman of the South Sudan Civil Society Alliance, says he has no knowledge of that fund.
I don't think we were asked as members of GMEC. We are wondering where did they get such a budget. Anything to be given to the members of the GMEC who are South Sudanese, we should have been consulted. They should have showed us exactly the budget.
Ajang is calling on the NPTC to release all available funds to speed up the process of screening, training, and unification of forces in the remaining 2 months. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Juba.
And the South Sudan Cabinet Affairs Minister's name is Martin Elia Lamora, not Elia Lamora Makana, as stated by me in the previous report. Authorities in Jonglei State have confirmed at least 7 people were killed and several others injured during a cattle raid last weekend in Twik East County. Dang Gai Deng has the story for VOA from Bor.
Jonglei State Information Minister Atong Kwal Manyang says the 7 deaths include 3 cattle raiders in Twik East County's Paliao village. Manyang says most of the cattle raiders escaped with dozens of cattle.
4 people had been killed and 2 people were injured. That is from the side of Jonglei State, and 3 criminals were killed.
Manyang says Jonglei State authorities are ill-equipped to prevent cattle raids like this from happening.
We do not have that big number of soldiers that we can send to every county and equip them with guns. That is not what we can afford as a state. We still need help from the national government. If more soldiers sent to help us in ensuring that we deal with these criminals.
Manyang says over the past few months, trade has been moving along without incident between Boma and Jonglei traders. She is urging communities in Jonglei State not to take law into their hands by attacking anyone from Boma State.
Traders from Boma State have been here with their cattle. Some of them are even living among us. They come and buy goods, they take them back and they bring their cattle. So trade is going as expected. But of course, like I said, these are individuals or few criminals are out of control of the Boma State government. And these are the spoilers of peace. They are trying to sabotage whatever is being achieved between these two states. So these are few people, and they will be dealt with wherever they are.
David Garang, chairman of the Jonglei State Civil Society Network, says he was shocked to hear civilians lost their lives during this time of peace.
It has been a painful situation to our vulnerable communities. We have peace between Boma and Jonglei State, and again, now we don't know what the problem is, as some people still waging attacks on other communities. Where is this peace now? There are still criminals doing such things.
Garang is calling on authorities in Boma and Jonglei states to do more to protect the lives and property of civilians. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Bor.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A look at the state of healthcare in Zimbabwe in the aftermath of a long doctor's strike there. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
why do you think more young people are turning away from farming?
You know, for you to farm, to be a farmer, you have to wait. I'm waiting, and you know, these guys, they don't want to wait. They want the money now. They don't want you to maybe you plant your corn or maize or yam, and you have to wait till probably like how many months before it germinates and before you can even harvest.
Maybe because they feel or they view farming to be an old occupation or vocation that's mostly for the villagers. But then I feel farming is one that I know you can generate money from.
In most cases, young people in Africa think white-collar jobs are the most earning. But in the real sense, it's the reverse.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time now for our Tuesday health segment, and today we're talking about healthcare in Zimbabwe. With no end in sight to the Zimbabwe doctors' strike over salaries and poor working conditions, desperate patients have looked to church-run mission hospitals for much-needed healthcare. Karanda Mission Hospital, about 200 kilometers north of the capital Harare, is overwhelmed by patients seeking treatment. Columbus Mavunga reports from Mount Darwin, near the border with Mozambique.
This evangelical church-run hospital was established in the 1960s to cater for patients in the Mount Darwin district of Zimbabwe. But because of a government doctor strike, which began 3 months ago, people like 39-year-old Darlington Henderson are traveling hundreds of kilometers to be treated here. Henderson, who has a broken hip, says he arrived more than 2 weeks ago. The place is flooded with people, says Henderson. He was told he would be seen on November 29, but doctors said they had more urgent cases, so he was told to come back this week. If I do not get treated now, he says, they said it will be in January. Canadian Dr. Paul Thistle is head of Karanda Mission Hospital. He says their patient numbers have more than doubled in the last 2 months.
That's what stresses on our human resources, our nurses, our doctors, plus our physical resources and medicines and surgical supplies. So Karanda is seen as the port of last hope for some people who have failed to access services elsewhere in the country. As you can see by the queues, some people may wait 2 or 3 days to get seen by a doctor. We triage, that is to say, if somebody's really sick, we move them up to the front of the line. But it's sometimes very difficult to assess how sick people are because everybody outside is unwell.
Mercy Taderera is with her 13-year-old Tanatswa Mapufu, who has a bladder infection. Their 300-kilometer journey hasn't resulted in a meeting with a doctor. Hence Taderera's plea to President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government and the doctors on strike. I wish they would value people's lives. So many people have died because of doctor strike. This is an appeal to both. The government must attend to the doctor's concerns, she says. International aid organizations have over the years funded Zimbabwe's neglected social sector, but that help has largely consisted of providing drugs and technical support. No help on salaries, which the doctors want increased to cope with soaring inflation. Dr. Alex Kasasira, the head of the World Health Organization in Zimbabwe, is hoping Zimbabwe officials and doctors find a solution to end the strike.
We are very worried that the most vulnerable will not be able to access the care they need. So we have been following the discussions, the dialogue, and we are hopeful that consensus will be reached and the health workers can be back on duty within the shortest time possible, because the poor and the most vulnerable are the ones most affected by this impasse.
That would surely be a relief to workers here and patients going for days without treatment here as doctors strike at state hospitals drags on. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Mount Darwin, Zimbabwe.
Thank you.
The UN High Commission for Refugees convened the three-day Global Refugee Forum in Geneva yesterday with over 2,000 attendees, including heads of state, refugees from 160 countries, and human rights experts. UNHCR says it's the largest and most important such gathering ever held. Two things the attendees may already agree on: the world's estimated 70 million refugees and internally displaced persons should be able to live in dignity and return home safely. And according to UNHCR spokesperson Catherine Mahoney, host countries cannot be expected to shoulder that burden alone.
The goal of this forum is to make sure that the whole of society is coming together to really ease the pressure on host communities in a way that is also enhancing refugee self-reliance.
Of course, this is especially relevant in sub-Saharan Africa.
Absolutely. I mean, sub-Saharan Africa is home to 6 million refugees. It's home to some of the largest, most protracted refugee situations in the world: Somalia, South Sudan, DRC, Burundi. These are long-term refugee situations where multiple generations of families are living as refugees. Just today, I received a photo of a 7-minute-old baby girl born weeks after her mother fled conflict breaking out in Burkina Faso. You know, so this is the reality that Africans are facing right now. But at the same time, you know, African countries have this long history of welcoming refugees and sharing the little resources that they have.
So what is UNHCR's short take on how to strike this balance?
I mean, I think we have to look at what policies are states implementing that are having a dramatic effect on a refugee's ability to support themselves in exile. So, for example, you have new laws in Ethiopia that are allowing refugees to open up their own bank accounts, new laws that are allowing refugees to get work permits. Now, in this situation, you want to have the opportunity for refugees to be able to provide and support themselves, but doing so in a way that is also opening up opportunities for Ethiopians themselves as well. Many people know that Uganda has long been a shining example where refugees who are seeking safety in Uganda get access to land. They also have freedom of movement. They also have the right to work, and they also have the right to open up their own businesses. If a refugee comes in and is able to spend money in local businesses, those local businesses will see this isn't just about taking jobs. This is about living in peaceful cohesion together and the way to move forward here.
This approach certainly challenges the idea that some people have that refugees have no skills and no real way to be anything but a burden on others.
Refugees are skilled workers. They're innovators, entrepreneurs. They're also taxpayers and consumers. So these are people that can enhance capital returns. They can boost innovation, and they ease pressure on the host community when they can contribute to growth and not rely on dependence and aid. The responsibility has to be shared, but at the same time, refugees have a lot to offer host communities, especially from an economic perspective.
I understand there'll be 6 main themes or domains of focus at the Global Refugee Forum, including education, burden and responsibility sharing, solutions, and protection capacity.
And one of them is a focus on climate, energy, and infrastructure. And it's a recognition that so much more needs to be done to save and protect our environment and to ease the pressure on the host communities while enabling refugees to meet their own energy needs in a sustainable way. You know, only 10% of the refugees worldwide have reliable access to electricity, for example, to light, heat, cook, power their own shelters. So in low and middle income countries, infrastructure, including schools and shelter, health centers, water and sanitation, are already overstretched and poorly equipped, not necessarily just to support potential new refugee arrivals, but also the host communities themselves. And we recognize that the responsibility is too often falling on those host communities to provide this infrastructure. So we need to make sure that we're not putting extra pressure on limited resources, and that we need to focus on better ways to provide infrastructure while we're advocating to make sure that refugees get integrated into those health systems, school systems, etc.
That was Catherine Mahoney, a global spokesperson for the UNHCR. She was speaking with VOA reporter Adam Phillips in New York. As Uganda's presidential nominations draw closer, politician Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as musician Bobby Wine, has vowed to rock the halls of power with a run for the top job. Wine describes President Yoweri Museveni's 33 years in power as a dictatorship. Museveni, meanwhile, has described Wine as an enemy of prosperity and in November called for additional riot police to deal with his opponent. Halima Atumani has more on the story for VOA from Kampala.
Ugandan musician turned lawmaker Bobby Wine was once known as the ghetto president for his support base in city slums. But 2019 became the year Wine announced a bid to challenge President Yoweri Museveni for the actual top office. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Wine says he decided to run for president because Museveni has lost touch with young Ugandans.
He believes that the way to deal with our generation is to deal with the young man that represents it, that's Bobby Wine, blocking my musical shows, blocking me from any public interaction, trying to make it hard for me to speak to the people out there. In my opinion, he seems to be fighting with a ghost he cannot touch.
Wine and his supporters describe Museveni, who has been president since 1986, as a dictator. For his part, Museveni calls Wine an enemy of progress because he asks foreigners not to invest in Uganda until there is a change in leadership. The government has used police beatings and pepper spray, known as kamlali, to shut down Wine's concerts and break up protests by his supporters. Museveni recently said that authorities need more muscle.
We now need manpower for the riot police to deal with some of our customers here in town, because we want just to kamlali without killing anybody.
Museveni is also trying to connect with young people and slum dwellers, a constituency that critics say he has ignored. In October, he appointed Wine's fellow musician, Mark Bugembe, known as Butcherman, as his presidential advisor on ghetto affairs. Butcherman, who took over the unofficial title of ghetto president when Wine became a lawmaker, rejects critics who say Museveni is using him.
So the ghetto president has no party. The development has no color. It is for all Ugandans. Dawa, I stood up just to come to save Uganda. Yes, I'm just there to connect the government with the ghetto people.
Analysts say Bobby Wine's quick rise in politics is due to young people tiring of false promises. Tolit Charles Atia is from the Institute for Policy Reflection and Security Studies.
So this wave we are seeing is a strong statement from the young persons that, men, there is a raw deal. There is a raw deal in this you're telling us, and I think we're going to confront it.
Uganda's Electoral Commission has scheduled presidential nominations for August 20 of this coming year, with Wine and Museveni expected to be their respective party's choice in the 2021 general election. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
And that's our show for this Tuesday. We leave you with the song Freedom by Emmy J. Yoweri.
Even though sorrow lasts for a night, surely joy comes in the morning. It is time for Southern Sudan to rejoice.
We've been listening to Emmy J. Yoweri with the song Freedom. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and we appreciate you inviting us into your vehicles and homes this evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.